She's a research fellow at Georgetown University's Berkeley Center, has worked with Beckett Law, defending religious freedom rights of all people, and has a JD from the University of Chicago. And our other discussant will be Professor Michael Moreland, who is University Professor of Law and Religion at Villanova University. And this didn't make it into the program, but he is the director of the Eleanor H. McCullen Center for Law, Religion, and Public Policy. He has a PhD and JD. And we're just delighted to hear from all of us today. I'll keep it short because I know we don't have a lot of time. But Dan, all yours.
Thank you. I'm really delighted to be here. This is, I'm going to present some of our recent research on religious and cultural change in the U.S. Based on three or four different major surveys we released in the last few years. So part one is looking at the decline of white Christian America. So overall, if you look at these sort of large religious categories of Protestant, Catholic, non-Christian communities, and unaffiliated, we see over the last 40 or so years a really precipitous decline of Americans who identify as Protestant or members of Protestant denominations, from 63% in 74 to fewer than half in 2016, 44%. For the Catholic population over this time, we see much more stability, only tailing off slightly over the last 5 or 6 years to 21% in 2016. One of the more important trends, that green line, is the rise of people who are religiously unaffiliated. And I'll get into this group a little bit later. But this is a group that includes people who are atheists, agnostic, just broadly secular, or unattached to religion in whatever variety of ways. In addition to the decline of these overall groups, we're also seeing really significant changes in the racial and ethnic composition of Protestants and Catholics. So here we see a really precipitous drop of Americans identifying as white Protestant. In the mid-70s, they made up roughly half of the US population, and currently it's about 35-36%. Over the same time, we see the number of African-American Protestants. That number is largely stable, and we're seeing in recent years an uptick in the number of Americans who are Latino Protestant. There's a really similar pattern occurring among Catholics, except perhaps a little bit more dramatic. Again, in the early 70s, when this trend data began, roughly a quarter of Americans were white Catholic. And then we see a really significant and rather steep decline over the last couple decades. Currently, only around 13% of the American public is white Catholic. And we're seeing a rather explosion among people who are Latino Catholic due to factors related to immigration and differential birth rates. I should also note that we're, if you look at generational differences among Catholics, that Catholics under 30, a majority are now Hispanic. So this is another way to look at these shifting demographic patterns. So if you look at the different age groups, so among your Christian seniors, these are Americans who are 65 years of age or older, nearly 8 in 10 are white. If you go looking at America's youngest Christian adults, age 18 to 29, only about half, 47% are white. So again, we're seeing a really significant shift in the racial and ethnic composition of American Christianity. Another way to look at this is looking at the overall differences in religious identity by age cohort. And as we see here, the religious character of this country differs markedly by age. In fact, I think it's safe to say there's no single religious landscape in the U.S. Each generation really reflects a significantly different mix of religious identities. So the blue bars over there are white Christian traditions. So you're white evangelical Protestant, white mainline, white Catholic, are all those blue bars. And if you look from the age 65 group, roughly two-thirds of those folks are some type of white Christian. You look at people who are under the age of 30, and it's less than 3 in 10. So we're seeing a sea change in our religious identity in the U.S. And why does this matter? Well, it matters because the cultural context of young adults is dramatically different than it was a generation ago. The types of people that young people are associating with, interacting with, are really different. They have many more opportunities to be exposed to different religious people, different religious beliefs and backgrounds. And these religious changes are challenging the notion of America's Christian identity as well. So this is one of the more remarkable trends I think we've seen in American religion over the last couple decades. Over the sort of first couple decades of this chart, we see that people who are religiously unaffiliated, only around 5, 6, 7% of the overall American adult population. And then in the early 90s, you see a significant uptick. And this has been widely reported. I'm sure many of you in this room are familiar with this stat. But one of the really remarkable things is actually we're seeing an acceleration of people identifying as unaffiliated. In our most recent survey, we found that 25% of Americans now identify that way. And unless we think that, you know, young people have always been less religious, we looked at this by decade. So we started in 1986 and looked at, well, where are young people in 1986? Well, only 10% weren't affiliated in 1986. Well, what about 1996? 20%? In 2006, 23%? Anyone want to hazard a guess to where we are now? 39% of Americans under the age of 30 are now religiously unaffiliated. Another way to display this data is looking at the distribution of age by people who are white Christian and unaffiliated. So your 18-year-olds, only a quarter of them are white Christian, and many more are unaffiliated, 36%. And as you skew older, go into people who are in their 40s and 50s and 60s, many more people are white Christian and many fewer are unaffiliated. So you can just imagine as we sort of look at generational replacement, as young people replace the older generations, what that's going to do to the character, the religious character of this country. So I sort of hopefully whetted your appetite in looking at these demographic trends, but now I want to look at some of the reasons as to why we think this is happening. And there's no one reason. There's lots of talk in the media and among religious scholars as to what's going on. We found that there are a number of significant reasons that are worth exploring. The most frequently cited reason when we ask Americans who've left their childhood religion why they left is that they simply stopped believing. So this is one of the most obvious reasons, but it's also one that I think it's less explored. We also asked about whether your family was never that religious growing up. Only 32% that said that was a precipitating factor. Negative religious teachings about the treatment of gay or lesbian people. Again, only a minority of people mentioned that as a precipitating factor. And many fewer said the clergy sex abuse scandal, a personal traumatic event, or that their church or congregation was getting too political. So by far, the most common explanation as for why people are leaving religion is because they no longer believe in the fundamental teachings of their childhood religion. Another interesting fact, and something that surprised us when we were doing this study, is when this is happening. Right, I think part of the conventional wisdom when we talk about religious change is that when people shift, right, from childhood to adulthood, when they go off to college perhaps, these big life events can often culminate in significant personal change or growth. But what we're seeing is that 62% of Americans who leave do so before their 18th birthday. So they do so most likely when they're still living at home with their parents. And this is also this pattern is particularly evident among the youngest Americans who are leaving. So Americans who are age 18, 29, who have left their childhood religion, 79% said that they did so before their 18th birthday. But if you look at your seniors, so people who are unaffiliated today but are much older, they left at a really different time. So they left in their college and post-college years, suggesting that the family environment was dramatically different back then than it is today. Another interesting fact that we learned throughout this study is that most people who are unaffiliated say that they nonetheless, the last time that they attended a religious service, it was relatively positive. So they didn't, you know, they didn't feel like either unwelcome or they didn't feel like they didn't belong. They generally report very positive experiences. So this is, it wasn't the fact that they went to a service and didn't feel very welcomed. That's we didn't find that at all. So it suggests that there's something else going on. Another reason that we're seeing really significant shifts in the overall levels of Americans who are religiously unaffiliated is because more Americans who are born and raised affiliated are staying that way. So a generation ago, what would happen often, so people, someone who was raised in a non-religious home would go out into the world, they would meet someone who is religious, often get married, and during the course of that, whether they had kids or just through the marriage, they would come back to religion, or they would come to religion. So among unaffiliated folks in the 1970s, 34%, only 34%, were still unaffiliated as adults. But you look at unaffiliated people in 2016, they're still that way. So they have not changed, suggesting that there's some reason why these folks are staying unaffiliated. And I can talk about some reasons why that might be the case. We also found out that among people who are unaffiliated, they're not really looking for religion at this point in time. So we didn't ask 5 years from now, 10 years from now. We asked, at this current point in time, are you looking for a religious community that's right for you? And only 7% of this group said yes, they were actively looking for a religious home. One of the things I want to talk about and explore as a possible reason here is the rise of homogamy among people who are religiously unaffiliated. And that's the tendency for people to marry people of similar backgrounds. So again, in the 1970s, when unaffiliated people got married, they tended to marry people who were religious. And this is not that surprising. If you remember in the 1970s, very few people were unaffiliated. So if you look at your potential prospective partners out there, most of them are going to be religious. But if you fast forward, 1980s, 1990s, 2000s, and the 2010s, so now what we're seeing is unaffiliated people increasingly marrying other people who are unaffiliated and basically creating secular couples and families. Again, and that has a lot to do with where we are and why we're seeing this unaffiliated identity being more resilient. And we can certainly talk in discussion why this is occurring now. We're also seeing it in the role that religious institutions are playing at really seminal moments in people's lives. So when we looked at weddings and the type of weddings that people were having, was it administered by a religious leader at a church or place of worship, a religious leader in a secular venue, or was it a secular service? We see really different patterns by age. So people who are seniors and people in their 50 to 64 age range tended to get married in their place of worship and was presided over by a religious leader. And that's not happening as often today. So young people who are getting married are opting for very different types of services. And it's reflecting the fact that we are seeing more of these sort of secular unaffiliated couples. So I talked earlier about sort of family dynamics, and one of the reasons that, you know, young people were leaving at an early age had to do with changing family dynamics. One of the things that has really shifted is the divorce rate, which peaked out around the early 1980s, right as the youngest millennials were being born. And what we see here is that young people who are people who are raised by married parents have very different religious experiences from those whose parents were divorced or separated. So 34% of people whose parents were married during their formative years say they attended weekly or more, and roughly two-thirds said that they at least attended monthly or yearly. If you look at people whose parents were divorced or separated during their formative years, much lower rates of religious participation. And why is that? Well, there's a number of reasons that have been explored by scholars and sociologists about how divorce can adversely impact religious socialization. I'll just tick off a couple here. I think joint custody arrangements can often create logistical hurdles. Regular religious participation definitely takes time, and parents dealing with joint custody arrangements generally have less of it. Children are no longer embedded in a single community, but are navigating between multiple communities, right, that can offer conflicting ideas about religion. Divorced parents may not agree on the priority of religious education in the first place, and may send children conflicting messages. Oh my goodness. And then finally, children of divorced parents often have emotional distance from their parents, and parents' moral authority is often diminished because of divorce. But these are not the only family dynamics that matter. We also found that among people who are raised in households with parents of different religious backgrounds, so Catholic, Protestant, Mormon, Jewish, they demonstrated much lower rates of religious involvement in childhood than parents than people whose parents had the same religious background. So we'll look at, for instance, religious affiliation. So nearly 6 in 10 Americans whose parents had similar religious backgrounds said they attended religious services weekly growing up. That's only 40% for those whose parents had different religious backgrounds. So this suggests that religious diversity may actually be inhibiting religious socialization for young folks today. Beyond formative experiences and family environment, the broader social context also appears to play a role. We looked at people with high and low religiously diverse networks, so the extent to which you have your important people in life are religiously similar to yourself or religiously very different. And people in highly religiously diverse contexts, again, demonstrate much lower levels of religious participation than people who are in relatively low diverse networks. And I'll show you a sort of interesting chart that this sort of shows how this plays out at the macro level. This is for a piece I wrote for 538, and looking at the degree of religious diversity by state and the level of religious commitment in those states. And as you can see, there's a pretty high correlation between the level of religious diversity and lower levels of religious commitment. So if you look at Oregon, for instance, among the one of the most diverse states and one of the least religious. Conversely, Mississippi, where half the state's adults are Baptist, is among the most has the most religiously committed population in the U.S. And this really suggests that the broader religious environment might also play a role. So it might not be your immediate social network, but the broader social context in which you live may play a role in your own religious attachments and commitments. One of the really interesting things about this group is we are seeing a significant cultural influence from people who aren't affiliated, but it's not showing up politically so much. And why is that? Well, essentially, they're not showing up to vote. So if you look at the size of the unaffiliated population in 2016, 25% of all Americans, only 15% of voters that year. So they're really underwhelming showing at the box office is limiting the amount of political impact that they can have. I know I'm really short on time, so I'm going to go through this pretty quick. So the other thing that is sort of coming along with these major demographic shifts that I talked about is we're seeing significant cultural changes occurring as well. So just look at the Obama presidency era. So over those 8 years, we saw the U.S. change from a majority white Christian to a minority white Christian nation. And we saw same-sex marriage go from 39% support to 58% support. Now that is a dramatic cultural shift occurring over a relatively very, very short time. And it's having a significant impact on the level of sort of cultural anxiety and insecurity that some groups are experiencing. We're also seeing shifts, as I mentioned earlier, about how different people are even understanding the role of Christian identity as part of the American experience or American as American history. So younger adults are much less likely than older Americans to say that being Christian is an important part of the American identity. So roughly a third or so of people who are 18-29 say it's somewhat very important. Among people who are seniors, 65 and up, the vast majority say that this is important. The same pattern occurs when you look at people who say the U.S. is a Christian nation. Again, young people are much less likely to say that the U.S. is a Christian nation. Only 32% say this compared to roughly half of seniors. And it follows that for young people today, their immediate sort of social context and environment is incredibly different. They're the most religiously, racially, ethnically diverse generation the country's ever seen, and it's really impacting how they perceive both themselves and the U.S. as a whole. There's also a religious dimension to this feeling of anxiety as well, and I won't go into this because I could do a whole presentation on white evangelicals in the 2016 election, but suffice it to say that white evangelicals are a group that feels particularly anxious about these cultural and demographic shifts. As you can see here, in 2012, close to half of white evangelical Protestants said that the U.S. has always been and is currently a Christian nation, down to 37% in 2016, and went from 48% to 59% saying the U.S. Used to be a Christian nation in the past. And this is very similar to the idea of feelings of nostalgia for the past. So a question that we've asked in 2012 is the extent to which American culture and way of life has gotten better or worse since the 1950s. And some of the groups most likely to say that American culture and way of life has changed for the worse are white Christians, so people that are seeing their numbers decline that the sort of cultural landscape, whether it's same-sex marriage or marijuana legalization, a lot of the issues are shifting out from beneath them. I'm going to add just one point here. If there's sort of one important reason why Trump carried white evangelical Protestants as easily as he did, I think it's this, that in the 2016 election, white evangelical Protestants went from becoming values voters to nostalgia voters. That this idea of nostalgia for the past was incredibly powerful and influenced their political calculations. I'm going to end on this slide because I'm basically well over time. But these cultural changes, cultural and demographic changes over the last couple decades have really engendered feelings of insecurity and anxiety among white Christians. And it's manifested in negative attitudes in some cases towards Muslims and immigrants. So if you look at American attitudes towards Islam, you see a sharp divide among religious communities, with white Christian groups expressing most negative sentiment towards these groups. So I'm going to wrap it up here. There are a few slides at the end, but I think I got through most of the important stuff. So thank you.
Thank you. Are these on? Can you hear that? Can you hear it in the back? Yes? Okay, excellent. Well, wonderful. Well, we appreciate that. Tour de force of skimming through major social and cultural changes in 5 minutes or less. But now we get to take another 5 minutes or less and discuss it. But I think certainly the big story here for many people is what Dan mentioned about the rise of the religiously unaffiliated. It's also been called the rise of the nuns, spelled N-O-N-E-S, sense of none of the above, people who are atheist, agnostic, unaffiliated, sort of all of those. And certainly also the issue of racial and cultural diversity among young adults. And I appreciate the way he laid out the family and social factors as well. But I want to think about sort of what are the political and legal implications of some of these changes. Do either of you want to comment about, say, the religiously unaffiliated? I mean, this is a major trend line. What implications is it going to have?
Well, I think it's what is in part fueling much of the current debate about religious freedom, because if a growing percentage of the population is unaffiliated, and of course, and Dan could fill in the details here, it's not that people are sort of affirmatively atheists or something like that, or sort of crusading non-believers, but they're detached from religion, they're indifferent about religion, certainly institutional religion. And so I think that has an effect then on how much they think religion is worth protecting in the legal and policy environment. And so in our current debates, which were much more, I think there's maybe this is nostalgia, but I think the debates about religious freedom in the, say, the mid-20th century up through the 1970s or 80s involving draft exemptions and the like, sure, there was some, you know, often some sharp rhetoric around them, but there was a general American consensus in favor of broad protections for religious exemption. And that has collapsed. And it's collapsed in part, I think, because a large percentage of the population, if still a minority, doesn't think religion is that valuable to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely want to second that there's this problem now that religion and the special role it plays and the understanding of religion as a motivating factor for serious action, whether it be positive or negative, is being diminished because there's just a lack of understanding of what religion is. And so similarly, sort of a byproduct of that is that in the various religious liberties or challenges and struggles that we're dealing with, this inability to understand the importance of religion kind of makes it seem that the core issue is something else, right? So whether it be something, even in the context of terrorism, that there's something else at play, it's not religion. Or if it's in the various culture war issue, it's well, it's not really religious liberty. Let's put that in quotes. There's something else, and often the word we hear is bigotry. So that's definitely going to lead to a lot of thorny issues in the legal realm. And then, of course, beyond the sort of experience of the unaffiliated themselves, there's the question of what does the rise of nuns mean in terms of the broader sort of those who are nostalgic and how they're reacting, and the backlash. And so some of the legal implications of that is what we're seeing in terms of minority communities, probably most prevalently the American Muslim community, and the type of harassment and discrimination issues that they're feeling, that they're experiencing, which is at least partly a byproduct of the sort of insecurity and anxiety that many are feeling.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, and I hope you take a minute and maybe tell us a little bit more. We saw some of the ones, the slides where Dan was explaining about the large percentage, particularly among white senior older populations, of negative views towards Islam. And we've seen that changes among younger cohorts. Do you see a change in the way the Muslim community in the United States is being perceived in the interactions that happen with changes in age, or is it still so, I don't know. Tell me what you're seeing.
Well, I mean, I think some of Dan's data did point to the fact that young Americans are more likely to be open to religious diversity, to diversity generally, right? And so that's why there's a more positive, other polls have shown there's a more positive view of American Muslims. And I think one explanation for that can be that there are more personal relationships being built between young Muslims and their Muslim peers. But another part of this is what we've been talking about, this idea that religion isn't important. And so to the extent that something like global terrorism for older Americans might necessarily and probably wrongly, I would argue, be associated with religion as a primary motivating factor for a lot of young Americans, they're kind of taking religion out of the equation. They're saying that Islam isn't the reason, and therefore a lot of the negative perceptions that flow from that are not at play.
Mm-hmm. Whether religion is the problem or religion is not even an issue, it's interesting the flip side that both of those can have. So some of these issues you see with racial and religious diversity are also playing out, particularly in the Catholic Church that Dan mentioned, with the increase of Latino population. Michael, maybe you could take a second and comment on your perceptions of what kind of impact that's going to have on American Catholicism.
Well, I think it's already having a significant effect. Catholicism is obviously a very large kind of differentiated church, the Catholic Church in the United States. There are about 77 million Catholics in the U.S. And what I think you see is that Catholics tend to inhabit the cultures in which they are formed. And so Not surprisingly, Latino Catholics, especially immigrant Latino Catholics, have a particular cultural manifestation, which they grew up in the church and manifest their Catholicism. What I think the story that Dan's data tells, and is familiar to those of us who work a lot in the Catholic environment, is that there has been a steep decline of both affiliation, but even sort of attachment to the church on the part of white Catholics, and that it's kind of this, I don't know, it's a, in some ways kind of a decline and fall story of the way in which the Catholic Church, you know, came as an immigrant church, was subject to persecution in the 19th and early 20th century, and then John F. Kennedy was elected president, and it seemed like, you know, everything was coming up roses, and then sort of having achieved that kind of cultural power in much of the United States, now the white Catholic population is declining in its salience. And so we'll see. I mean, I think one of the things that Dan's data reveals is that religion depends on kind of a formative cultural environment to flourish. And that's, from what I can tell, that's certainly true in the LDS church. It's true in the Catholic church. And the fact is that in a lot of Catholic parishes, certainly in the Protestant mainline churches, that formative cultural environment has withered away to a more or less of an extent. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, and certainly any kind of consensus on the role religion should play in society generally, the role religion should play in the schools is changing. And that's, you know, for both good and ill, perhaps, I don't know, but that's interesting. I think we see it also politically. One issue that's interested me in tracking the rise of the Latino population in the United States has been looking at, say, the political impact where Catholics have been pretty evenly split between Republicans and Democrats over the years. But the Latino population, probably, because of immigration issues largely, you could probably speak to that, but is much more solidly Democrat-leaning. Do you see tensions or cultural tensions between sort of the white traditional Catholics and the Latino Catholics that are coming in?
Well, again, it depends on the particular part of the country population. Cubans, for instance, are heavily Republican, especially in Florida. But I do agree that partly because of immigration issues. It is, I think, an issue that the Republican Party is, let's say, struggling with right now. Because I worked in the White House for George W. Bush, including on some immigration-related issues. And, you know, one of the things that, at least in Republican conservative politics, always pointed out is that there's no reason why Latinos should be kind of natural Democrats, right? I mean, they tend to have very kind of strong family values. They tend to be very kind of entrepreneurial and the like. And so I do think it's a struggle for the Republican Party right now to find the discourse around immigration-related issues given the importance of the Latino population in the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, one thing I wanted to sort of explore and think about is political impact, both looking at the Democrats, the Republicans in general, but the Democratic Party has its own issue. They both have really interesting implications and issues. Both of them, in some ways, have this issue of uncomfortable bedfellows, right? I mean, you have the traditional Democratic voters that have, you know, sort of heavy Latino and African American support, but then you have this sort of young, rising millennial young adult generation that's more unaffiliated and less religious. Whereas, you know, Latino Americans and African Americans tend to have much higher levels of religiosity. I'm curious what both of you see, and you know, maybe interested to hear as well sort of your perception of the Muslim community as well, sort of which way it cuts politically. Certainly, my assumption, I mean, the way I've followed it, it's been more split until recently, whereas now, because of immigration issues, there's a lot of strong reaction against sort of the Republicans and those who've been engaged on issues involving the ban on people coming from majority Muslim countries.
Yeah, well, I think your perception's interesting, and also the fact that you pinned it on immigration issues, which I think I'm sure partly inform the sort of major shift that has taken place where, you know, growing up, you know, my parents always voted Republican, and that was sort of the general norm among my peers, and, starting with George W. Bush, that changed. Mm-hmm. And there was this huge swing towards pretty much the norm now is for American Muslims to be Democrats. And I think especially in the last election, you know, it's interesting that the people who there would be like one person, like the one Muslim who voted for Trump. You know, we all know his name. His name is Sajjad Tahrir. He gave that benediction at the RNC. And it's just, you know, it's just like, who is this guy? And he's kind of like made like famous just by virtue of the fact that he's both Muslim and, you know, Republican, or specifically a pro-Trump. And what was the reason for that?
Yeah,
you know, and a lot of, I mean, currently a huge reason for that is because many American Muslims kind of, they perceive Republicans and conservatives generally as being not interested in them. Mm-hmm. They say a lot of really mean things and are about American Muslims and haven't, you know, in the view of the community, attempted to reach out to them and to form alliances, and they feel under attack. Mm-hmm. And so and on the flip side, a lot of people on the left have made very sort of proactive steps, taken a lot of steps to engage American Muslims and to help empower them through various means. I mean, I myself have gone through amazing high level, you know, totally free like media trainings, for instance, all organized by various, you know, liberal organizations. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's just like in that dynamic, like who's coming out and vocally supporting you and helping you sort of rise up and become empowered at a time when you feel persecuted, mm-hmm. and under attack. And who are the people who are attacking? Mm-hmm. And of course, for me, as somebody who works on religious liberty issues and has a really broad view of religious liberty, both as something, you know, something that's not liberal or conservative, but is encompassing, you know, that's beyond politics and encompasses people of all faith traditions. You know, it's an interesting dynamic to witness, because in the process of that, in the process of making these alliances, the question becomes, what is American Muslim community losing? Not just what, I mean, there's a question also of what is the right losing, what are conservatives losing by not forming those alliances, but also what is the community losing in terms of giving up a lot of its you know, strong sort of religious, mm-hmm. positions, mm-hmm. and allowing that to be subsumed by essentially what's identity politics.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then that's the interesting question, is sort of where things are going with the Democrats. There's this, a number of people have said sort of the Democrats have a religion problem, that they have this sort of bastion of traditionally fairly religious voters. I mean, and you see even Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, people talking about their faith, but then you have the tension with the rise of unaffiliated who are much less supportive of religion, and they, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but they overwhelmingly vote Democratic. And so you have these sort of interesting pairing of more religious or very religious and less. Where do you think the Democratic Party is going to go with that? Do either of you have any thoughts? Or?
I'll jump in.
Please.
Quickly. One of the interesting things, as Ozma was talking, the API community has undergone the same transition from reliable Republican to basically staunchly Democrat in like 20, 30 years. So, I mean, I don't know the reasons. I think the explanation that, you know, just showing up is really important. But as far as the Democratic Party, you know, if you look at the Republican voting religious coalition over the last 20 or so years, it stayed relatively stable, which is probably not that surprising or concerning, except when you realize that the American demography has changed dramatically over the same period of time. So, for instance, roughly 8 in 10 of George H.W. Bush's voters were white Christian, and Donald Trump's voters, same again, roughly 8 in 10 white Christian. The white Christian population, or the supporters of Democratic candidates, has fallen precipitously over the same period of time. So Bill Clinton, roughly 6 in 10 of his voters were white Christian. For Obama, when he ran in 2012, it was only 37%. I haven't run the numbers for 2016, but it'll probably be lower. So for the Democrats, I mean, the parties are facing different problems. For Democrats, it's like you have this mishmash of very religious voters, African-American Protestants, Latino Catholics, people who are kind of atheist and anti-religious. So how do you really work on a message that appeals to this really diverse broad swath of voters? And for Republicans, I think it's trying to broaden their religious coalition.
Well, and that's my next question, is looking at the Republicans that, you know, also have sort of internally conflicting populations, where you have a younger generation with a very different take on sexual orientation and gender identity rights versus older generations. The younger population tends to be more religiously and ethnically diverse. What are your thoughts on where the Republicans are going to go with this?
Before the 2016 election, I think the prevailing wisdom among political consultants and all that was that the Republican Party needed to become, I don't know exactly less religious, but certainly have less of a kind of overtly religious appeal and needed to, become more moderate and whatnot. It turns out, that in some ways people thought that the 2004 Bush re-election was kind of squeezing the last bit of votes that you could get out of the Republican base. And surprisingly then, Trump won. Now granted, he won in part by...
Did your microphone stop?
He won in part by... an electoral college kind of quirk because he lost the popular vote, but nonetheless he was able to carry a lot of the Republican base and broaden it a little bit, especially in some working class parts of the country in the upper Midwest. Now, how that in the long term plays out, especially in light of certain cultural issues, I don't know. I mean, I think that it was such a earthquake, his victory, to what I think political scientists and others had thought were the prevailing trend lines, and I think it's very hard to know.
Interesting. Well, and I'm curious too, the impact you see this having on culture war issues. Mm-hmm. I mean, if the younger generations are becoming more religiously and ethnically diverse, on the one hand, maybe there's less interest in fighting a culture war. I mean, for a long time, that seemed to be the prevailing wisdom, was that was part of the reason that people went unaffiliated, was a reaction against religion's engagement in the political sphere, although I appreciate Dan's data showing that that's actually one of the, 16%, as opposed to some of the larger...
Yeah, no, it was not top issue for any of them. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. But to what extent are these going to be continued to be supported and fueled?
Well, I think it depends on the issue. So, Dan's data bears out what I think is pretty readily apparent, that on the same-sex marriage issue, that mm-hmm. younger people tend to be even religious. I'm struck by, I was visiting Notre Dame the last couple of years. I teach at Villanova, which is a Catholic university, that even among younger, very observant Catholics, there tends to be support for same-sex marriage, very strong kind of views that are hostile to any form of LGBT discrimination. But on the other hand, on the abortion issue, which is another classic kind of culture war issue, I actually think that the conservative message has some traction. I think that the polling data on pro-life views among younger people have actually been kind of surprisingly steady. I think there's kind of a resonance with that kind of argument for complicated reasons. And so, I think actually that to the extent people were parsing the differences between the candidates on these issues, that in some ways it was the Democratic Party's abortion extremism that maybe was hurtful to them, both at the top of the ticket and maybe lower down on the ballot, and that the Republican message was actually some people think that's right.
I mean, so part of this, ties back again to this idea, with the unaffiliated, the religion is not important, right? So if you're going to look at a lot of the religious liberty culture war issues, you're going to, again, not see it as these issues being motivated by some sort of deeply held, belief, by religious believers who are duty-bound to kind of live in accordance with their faith, but more so, religion as a pretext. Mm-hmm. And we see that a lot in the way the media portrays these issues, right? It's like religious liberties are, again, always in sort of quotation marks.
Yes, exactly.
And they're always sort of thought of as a pretext. My experience sort of like pre-Trump and post-Trump when working on religious liberty issues is that, you see this phenomenon, and you also see the religious liberty arguments in these cultural war cases, whether it be Hobby Lobby, Little Sisters of the Poor, and now the upcoming, Masterpiece, Cake Shop case, they're pretty nuanced and intellectual. Like, they're strong, and they make total sense to me, because I think about them, but if you're going to try to explain them in, like, two sentences in an op-ed, or soundbite on media, it doesn't come through. It's a complicated argument. You have to sit there and think about the way rights and liberties work and the ways that we should, protect our liberties from government encroachment and so on. But it's hard, or it's so much more easier just to say, war on women or it's taking away your access, you know, it's taking away your rights and your entitlement to contraception or to drugs or healthcare. I mean, all these things are buzzwords that are much more compelling. It seems though now in sort of like the post-Trump era, with so many, you know, various organizations and commentators out there who are, you know, who do have messages that are problematic to the younger generation and that they're really concerned about, that issue of like, can I be compelled to facilitate that speech is probably something that has more, it's something that might actually click, I think. And so I wonder how that's gonna play out, if it's really sort of, if in order to protect that right to, you know, not be forced to facilitate a certain message or to disseminate a certain message, if the fact that you're finally sort of like emotionally drawn to that idea, how that's going to play out in some of these other cases.
Well, and that's that interests me, this sense that, I mean, and that's certainly the case that the U.S. Supreme Court has taken to hear next term on the baker who refused to bake a cake for a same-sex marriage celebration. And it's called Masterpiece Cake Shop, that Asma alluded to. This issue of religious liberty and non-discrimination, it's an interesting one, and it's certainly a major issue now. And what your comment is suggests two things. One thing I was thinking was this idea that whether younger generation, millennials and so forth, who don't have particular animus against religion, although they may be less affiliated with it, whether the tide of sentiment that now is very much sort of pro-LGBT rights and less supportive in some contexts, like you mentioned, of say Hobby Lobby or Little Sisters of the Poor, of religious freedom rights, whether there's a point in the future when that'll shift around. When, and this ties into the other question I wanted to get you all thinking, you're both lawyers, what kinds of legal challenges are we going to see? I mean, at some point will the legal challenges just be such that it will generate support for religious freedom, or is this sort of a losing battle straight on?
Well, I think a lot of it depends. I mean, there's the sort of the Supreme Court level of the debate, and then there's the more popular level of the debate. I think a lot depends on how strong the commitment is over the timeline for not just for freedom of religion, but also freedom of speech. It's interesting that I see a lot of polling data now that support for freedom of speech among younger people is declining. A lot of the contemporary controversies about campuses, not they should have speech codes on campuses and the like, and it was heartening, at least from the at the Supreme Court level a few weeks ago, the court handed down two cases on the same day, one involving a trademark for a band called The Slants, and whether or not the government in giving trademark registrations could discriminate based on disparagement, and the court said no, that there's no hate speech exception to the First Amendment, and also another case involving social media access for a convicted sex offender, and the court held that was the social media restriction was unconstitutional. And so at the level of the Supreme Court, there's this great kind of solid core of kind of free speech principled protection. And I think to the extent that religious freedom is seen as of a piece of that in the legal debate, then religious freedom will continue to prevail in cases like Hobby Lobby and Trinity Lutheran, the case involving the playground access to public funding. But to the extent that religion is seen as something else, as something that's, you know, kind of maybe something that we think is problematic, socially divisive, a source of, you know, problems in our lives, then I think religious freedom will be in trouble. And that's why the rise of the unaffiliated is so concerning.
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's not just, for the most part, not just at the Supreme Court. I've always sort of had my faith in law generally, that there's the jurisprudence, there's clarity there. I mean, not in all cases, but in some cases. There's clarity there that, and it continues to the extent that we're, you know, applying precedent and judges have a clear understanding of the jurisprudence, then that will sort of provide the protections for these rights, regardless of, you know, where social culture is headed. Of course, I think things are slightly different, again, now in the Trump era, as you know, everything is different in the Trump era. But it was kind of eye-opening what happened, for instance, in the cases with the travel ban. And some of, you know, basically the way that the Supreme Court deviated from the lower court holdings on that. And there were a lot of lower courts of opinion was very sort of motivated by this sort of anti-Trump sentiment and this desire to push back against, you know, bigotry and discrimination, whereas the Supreme Court took a more sort of level-headed response and kind of looked at the issues and sort of parsed it out, probably to some, you know, still problematically, but took a more sort of like the traditional impartial view on it, looking at it just really in terms of the presidential powers, as opposed to, you know, as I saw on Facebook, it's not so much about what Donald Trump can do, it's about looking at it as to what the president can do. And so that sort of distinction. So I think that's where that you might see a distinction between the Supreme Court and the lower courts at this point.
Mm-hmm. Well, and another question too is when we start talking about religious freedom, a lot of people assume that this is all about the Supreme Court, when as a practical matter, most of the things that affect religious believers happen at the state level, the local level, not just, I mean, that are issues of legislation rather than that. In this context, one of the, I saw a piece of survey data not too long ago that was really quite troublesome, that talked about provision of services to same-sex marriages scenario, the one like the Masterpiece Cake Shop that's coming up to the Supreme Court next year. And it reported that only 18% of Americans could sympathize at least somewhat with both sides. And I think this is, we see this reflected in a lot of other ways, and I'm sure you've probably got other data that are much stronger evidence of this, but some of the problems for at the level of working together as people, having a discourse, a way to work beyond partisanship and one's own frame of reference to be able, I mean, that's the kind of thing that, say, legislation encourages. People working together with people who they don't agree with, trying to find compromises, trying to find, you know, work around something that will work with other people. I don't know where you see that going. Is there, do you see hope for the increase in that level of understanding of various sides or of discourse politically, or are we sort of locked into a negative spiral right now?
Well, I think it's incumbent on those of us who are religious and inhabit religious institutions to do a good job of telling the story of why religion is good, why large religious institutions, and let's not be mistake here, people I think still have sympathy for kind of the individual, you know, religious claimant, you know, the draft objector or something like that. But so much of the debate now is around larger religious institutions, whether it be Catholic hospitals or religiously affiliated universities or some business owners like Hobby Lobby. And I think that it's important to articulate as forcefully but as attractively as possible the good that religious institutions do, the good that religion does in civil society, and so that it's not just the growth, as Tocqueville diagnosed, the potential for the growth of individualism on the one hand and statism as well, because they come together. And if civil society, including most preeminently religious institutions, wither away, what a dark thing that would be for our political order. And so I think that's the story that has to be told. And as you say, it was at the local level, right? So people see that, I mean, you know, to think of religion in the abstract maybe isn't very helpful, but to think about the good that Brigham Young does in a community in a state like this, the good that Catholic institutions and hospitals do in their communities, I think that's the important task ahead.
There's like eight things I want to respond to that Michael said. I'll try to just get to a couple. First, I think that's right. Like, if religious institutions do decline, what is there to replace them? I think that's a big question mark. If you look at people who are unaffiliated, they're less engaged politically, which is what I show, but they're also much less likely to be engaged socially, civically. And so if we lose that institution, is there something that can sort of take its place to sort of help us build a civil society? And that's, I think, a big, scary question mark for a lot of folks. Robert Putnam's seminal work on Bowling Alone, I think, started to look at that issue, and I think it's only accelerated since he did that a couple decades ago. the other thing that I think I would say about the sort of, and I would say it's sort of a danger, perhaps, is that during the 90s, one of the things that happened is the rise of the Christian right effectively branded Christianity for a entire generation who sort of looked at Christianity and said, wow, this is about sexuality issues. It's not about soup kitchens. It's not about the good that religious communities do in their communities. It's about these couple hot button issues. Pelvic politics is what we call them in political science. And so I think to the extent that religion gets associated with these really hot button divisive issues, and to Michael's point, the sort of a lot of the really good on the ground work that religious people and religious communities do is overshadowed, I think will be challenging, because there's more people than ever being raised without that kind of connection to religious communities. So they learn about religion often secondhand through the media and other ways.
Well, and I think that ties in with the question I'd like to end on is, what kind of message would you recommend? I mean, in trying to, people here are sympathetic to religious freedom, presumably, or at least interested in it. What kind of message works in discussing these issues with this risingly group of unaffiliated young Americans? Thoughts?
Well, I would say start by emphasizing, you know, why religion matters and why, and therefore why religious liberty matters, right? It's sort of like the core sort of motivating factor, you know, to do God, and the fact that there's like a duty element to it. Because I think that element of like being bound by something might be something that might seem foreign. That's not, so a lot of religious believers feel that this is what I have to do in order to please God. And sort of emphasizing that element in the way that it motivates, as Michael and Dan mentioned, many people do tremendous good.
Right, that religion and religious institutions, especially in their corporate expressed, not for-profit necessarily, although that too, but religious institutions in their corporate form and religious believers are a force for the good, have always been in our political society, and that to abandon that legacy and to kind of put them under the thumb of the state, as would be, you know, some of these religious freedom debates would entail, would be a very bad turn for American law and politics.
Well, thank you. Well, please join me in thanking our panel.